Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel avanzado C1. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Britain's Parliament is broken. It is a fire risk. It is insanitary. Asbestos worms its way through the building. Many of the pipes and cables that carry heat, water, electricity and gas were installed just after the war and should have been replaced in the 1970s. Some of them date from the 19th century. The older the steam pipes become, the more likely they are to crack or leak. When high-temperature, high-pressure steam enters the atmosphere, it expands at speed, generating huge, explosive energy. Such force could be fatal for anyone close. It could also disturb asbestos and send it flying through the ventilation system to be inhaled by palace workers. The building caught fire 40 times between 2008 and 2012. Last year, a malfunctioning light on an obscure part of the roof caused an electrical fire that could have spread rapidly had it not been detected at once. Whatever else happens in the Palace of Westminster, that great neo-Gothic pile on the Thames, one thing is constant. Every hour of every day, 4 or 5 members of the fire safety team are patrolling the palace, hunting for flames. Away from the grand chambers of the House of Commons and House of Lords, away from the lofty corridors, away from the imposing committee rooms with their carved doors, the palace is tatty, dirty and infested with vermin. Its lavatories stink, its drains leak. Some of the external stonework has not been cleaned since it was built in the 1840s and is encrusted with a thick coat of tarry black that is eating away at the masonry. Inside the building, intricate fan vaulting is flaking off, damaged by seeping rainwater and leaking pipes. Its Gothic Revival artworks are decaying. In the Lord's Chamber, the once golden sculptures of the barons who signed the Magna Carta are now dull grey, pitted and corroded. Nevertheless, the Palace of Westminster is seductive. It wants to beguile those who encounter it with its fantasy of Britishness. The national mythology that the palace promotes from every frescoed wall is of a country where good Queen Bess forever reigns, where the knights of the Round Table still quest for the Grail. Conservative backbencher Sir Edward Lee told me that in his mind the building is inextricably linked with British freedom. We are the only important country in Europe that has never been a police state, never had a police state imposed on us. We are the oldest functioning democracy of any major country. To me, this should be valued. This is not just an office block, it's the symbolic centre of the nation. Lee is right that the palace is more than just a building. It is the place, grand and tawdry, magnificent and squalid, that symbolises everything, both good and bad, about Britain and its democracy. Now it is dilapidated, ramshackle and dangerous, and no one seems willing or able to fix it. If you look back over time, there has been no shortage of people saying that something should be done. And then you look at the excuses for not doing anything. Too expensive, too embarrassing, too soon after the war, which gives you a very vivid impression of how long this has been going on. The administration of the parliamentary estate, which includes a number of satellite buildings, is overseen by commissions of the Lords and Commons, akin to boards of directors, although the monarch still officially retains control over portions of the palace. There is no single chief executive figure, and a complex tangle of departments deals with the building's upkeep. Screeds of further studies, papers and parliamentary inquiries have warned bleakly of a looming crisis, of a tale of decay, disrepair and dilapidation. The Cassandras, who have authored these reports, most recently a joint committee of both Houses of Parliament, warn of constant danger of flood, of the ever-present threat presented by asbestos, and most urgently, a risk of a major conflagration. With a hint of desperation, the committee in its findings of 2016 compared the difficulty of trying to keep the palace safe despite continual aggressive maintenance to trying to fill a bathtub with a thimble while the water is draining out of the plug hole at the other end. What is needed, the report argues, is a thoroughgoing renovation programme, preferably undertaken over about 6 years in an empty palace. The problem is that MPs are caught in a trap. The renovations, it was estimated in June 2015, will cost a minimum of £3.5 billion. If parliamentarians choose to stay in the building, the work could take 40 years and cost £5.7 billion. Spending vast amounts of money on their own workplace feels to many politically impossible. Some of them fear that moving out of the Palace of Westminster could indelibly alter Parliament's culture. Flinders said there are those who realise that if they allow new intakes of MPs to go into a new chamber with new atmospheres, new ways of doing things, places for everyone to sit, new procedures, new ways of talking, they may refuse to go back into what may to them feel like an antique shop.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Britain's Parliament is broken. It is a fire risk. It is insanitary. Asbestos worms its way through the building. Many of the pipes and cables that carry heat, water, electricity and gas were installed just after the war and should have been replaced in the 1970s. Some of them date from the 19th century. The older the steam pipes become, the more likely they are to crack or leak. When high-temperature, high-pressure steam enters the atmosphere, it expands at speed, generating huge, explosive energy. Such force could be fatal for anyone close. It could also disturb asbestos and send it flying through the ventilation system to be inhaled by palace workers. The building caught fire 40 times between 2008 and 2012. Last year, a malfunctioning light on an obscure part of the roof caused an electrical fire that could have spread rapidly had it not been detected at once. Whatever else happens in the Palace of Westminster, that great neo-Gothic pile on the Thames, one thing is constant. Every hour of every day, four or five members of the fire safety team are patrolling the palace, hunting for flames. Away from the grand chambers of the House of Commons and House of Lords, away from the lofty corridors, away from the imposing committee rooms with their carved doors, The palace is tatty, dirty, and infested with vermin. Its lavatories stink, its drains leak. Some of the external stonework has not been cleaned since it was built in the 1840s and is encrusted with a thick coat of tarry black that is eating away at the masonry. Inside the building, intricate fan vaulting is flaking off, damaged by seeping rainwater and leaking pipes. Its Gothic Revival artworks are decaying. In the Lord's Chamber, the once golden sculptures of the barons who signed the Magna Carta are now dull grey, pitted and corroded. Nevertheless, the Palace of Westminster is seductive. It wants to beguile those who encounter it with its fantasy of Britishness. The national mythology that the palace promotes from every frescoed wall is of a country where good Queen Bess forever reigns, where the Knights of the Round Table still quest for the Grail. Conservative backbencher Sir Edward Lee told me that in his mind the building is inextricably linked with British freedom. We are the only important country in Europe that has never been a police state, never had a police state imposed on us. We are the oldest functioning democracy of any major country. To me, this should be valued. This is not just an office block. It's the symbolic centre of the nation. Lee is right that the palace is more than just a building. It is the place, grand and tawdry, magnificent and squalid, that symbolises everything, both good and bad, about Britain and its democracy. Now it is dilapidated, ramshackle and dangerous, and no one seems willing or able to fix it. If you look back over time, there has been no shortage of people saying that something should be done. And then you look at the excuses for not doing anything. Too expensive, too embarrassing, too soon after the war, which gives you a very vivid impression of how long this has been going on. The administration of the parliamentary estate, which includes a number of satellite buildings, is overseen by commissions of the Lords and Commons, akin to boards of directors, although the monarch still officially retains control over portions of the palace. There is no single chief executive figure, and a complex tangle of departments deals with the building's upkeep. Screeds of further studies, papers and parliamentary inquiries have warned bleakly of a looming crisis, of a tale of decay, disrepair and dilapidation. The Cassandras, who have authored these reports, most recently a joint committee of both Houses of Parliament, warn of constant danger of flood, of the ever-present threat presented by asbestos, and most urgently, a risk of a major conflagration. With a hint of desperation, the committee in its findings of 2016 compared the difficulty of trying to keep the palace safe despite continual aggressive maintenance to trying to fill a bathtub with a thimble while the water is draining out of the plug hole at the other end. What is needed, the report argues, is a thoroughgoing renovation programme, preferably undertaken over about 6 years in an empty palace. The problem is that MPs are caught in a trap. The renovations, it was estimated in June 2015, will cost a minimum of £3.5 billion. If parliamentarians choose to stay in the building, the work could take 40 years and cost £5.7 billion. Spending vast amounts of money on their own workplace feels to many politically impossible. Some of them fear that moving out of the Palace of Westminster could indelibly alter Parliament's culture. Flinders said there are those who realise that if they allow new intakes of MPs to go into a new chamber with new atmospheres, new ways of doing things, places for everyone to sit, new procedures, new ways of talking, they may refuse to go back into what may to them feel like an antique shop.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Britain's Parliament is broken. It is a fire risk. It is insanitary. Asbestos worms its way through the building. Many of the pipes and cables that carry heat, water, electricity and gas were installed just after the war and should have been replaced in the 1970s. Some of them date from the 19th century. The older the steam pipes become, the more likely they are to crack or leak. When high-temperature, high-pressure steam enters the atmosphere, it expands at speed, generating huge explosive energy. Such force could be fatal for anyone close. It could also disturb asbestos and send it flying through the ventilation system to be inhaled by palace workers. The building caught fire 40 times between 2008 and 2012. Last year, a malfunctioning light on an obscure part of the roof caused an electrical fire that could have spread rapidly had it not been detected at once. Whatever else happens in the Palace of Westminster, that great neo-Gothic pile on the Thames, one thing is constant. Every hour of every day, four or five members of the fire safety team are patrolling the palace, hunting for flames. Away from the grand chambers of the House of Commons and House of Lords, away from the lofty corridors, away from the imposing committee rooms with their carved doors, the palace is tatty, dirty and infested with vermin. Its lavatories stink, its drains leak. Some of the external stonework has not been cleaned since it was built in the 1840s and is encrusted with a thick coat of tarry black that is eating away at the masonry. Inside the building, intricate fan vaulting is flaking off, damaged by seeping rainwater and leaking pipes. Its Gothic Revival artworks are decaying. In the Lord's Chamber, the once golden sculptures of the barons who signed the Magna Carta are now dull grey, pitted and corroded. Nevertheless, the Palace of Westminster is seductive. It wants to beguile those who encounter it with its fantasy of Britishness. The national mythology that the palace promotes from every frescoed wall is of a country where good Queen Bess forever reigns, where the knights of the Round Table still quest for the Grail. Conservative backbencher Sir Edward Lee told me that in his mind the building is inextricably linked with British freedom. We are the only important country in Europe that has never been a police state, never had a police state imposed on us. We are the oldest functioning democracy of any major country. To me, this should be valued. This is not just an office block. It's the symbolic centre of the nation. Lee is right that the palace is more than just a building. It is the place, grand and tawdry, magnificent and squalid, that symbolises everything, both good and bad, about Britain and its democracy. Now it is dilapidated, ramshackle and dangerous, and no one seems willing or able to fix it. If you look back over time, there has been no shortage of people saying that something should be done. And then you look at the excuses for not doing anything. Too expensive, too embarrassing, too soon after the war, which gives you a very vivid impression of how long this has been going on. The administration of the parliamentary estate, which includes a number of satellite buildings, is overseen by commissions of the Lords and Commons, akin to boards of directors, although the monarch still officially retains control over portions of the palace. There is no single chief executive figure, and a complex tangle of departments deals with the building's upkeep. Screeds of further studies, papers and parliamentary inquiries have warned bleakly of a looming crisis, of a tale of decay, disrepair and dilapidation. The Cassandras, who have authored these reports, most recently a joint committee of both Houses of Parliament, warn of constant danger of flood, of the ever-present threat presented by asbestos, and most urgently, a risk of a major conflagration. With a hint of desperation, the committee in its findings of 2016 compared the difficulty of trying to keep the palace safe despite continual aggressive maintenance to trying to fill a bathtub with a thimble while the water is draining out of the plug hole at the other end. What is needed, the report argues, is a thoroughgoing renovation programme, preferably undertaken over about 6 years in an empty palace. The problem is that MPs are caught in a trap. The renovations, it was estimated in June 2015, will cost a minimum of £3.5 billion. If parliamentarians choose to stay in the building, the work could take 40 years and cost £5.7 billion. Spending vast amounts of money on their own workplace feels to many politically impossible. Some of them fear that moving out of the Palace of Westminster could indelibly alter Parliament's culture. Flinders said there are those who realise that if they allow new intakes of MPs to go into a new chamber with new atmospheres, new ways of doing things, places for everyone to sit, new procedures, new ways of talking, they may refuse to go back into what may to them feel like an antique shop.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 0.
Hello, my name is Louise Adlon Tang, and my family comes originally from Carriquet, New Brunswick. And I want to speak in regards to the history of the Acadian and Mi'kmaq people of New Brunswick, because not a lot of Canadians know the full scope of the story.
Extract 1.
The Acadian people were relatively prosperous because the Mi'kmaq taught us how to be self-sufficient. And we had skill sets from France as well that came in with the people. And we were fishermen, we were farmers. Actually, the Acadian people created a system of farming using something called the abattoir.
Extract 2.
Now, the Acadian people were really fantastic when it came to resourcefulness and creating their own stuff. Because they had little support from France, they made their own homes, they made their own materials, they made their own fabrics, they...
Extract 3.
And in the colonial U.S. areas, they envied our wealth. They would come to do trade with us. We would sell them their goods, but we would sell our goods to them, but we weren't buying from them as much because we were so self-sustainable.
Extract 4.
So what they did was Amherst made the order to do the genocide using the smallpox against the Mi'kmaq people. And they did this by way of handkerchiefs and blankets that were stolen from hospitals. When they gave the wooden box, they were told not to open it until they got home or to their village to share the blessings. So that genocide took place.
Extract 5.
The Vatican Concordat, 1610, actually identified the Mi'kmaq as a nation internationally. And it was a recognition at the European level to facilitate trade between the Mi'kmaq and Europe. And this was an actual wampum that was created. It was an agreement with the Vatican directly. It had nothing to do with the crown.
Extract 6.
The Acadian people lived with us. We were one territory, one people, integrated Mi'kmaq and the Métis and the French harmoniously. Our agreement said that in order for us to maintain this treaty in good faith, we had to become Catholic. So Henri Member 2 was the sachem of the...
Extract 7.
My mom's grandfather was Laurent Lanteng. He owned a store in Saint-Simon, which is a little area outside Carriquet, New Brunswick. And he didn't know how to read. He didn't know numbers. He didn't know how to write. And he owned a shop. And he would keep tabs of all the line of credit by scrawling his own system of handwriting in the barn at the back of the store.
Extract 8.
So they did everything they could to systematically separate the people from the Catholic Church and to suppress our memory of these knowledge. But we were very good at keeping the oral tradition alive because we were indigenous people. That's how we always did it. So the story continued. Every girl in my family's first name was Marie. All the guys were Joseph. And that was the way that we kept these things going.
Extract 9.
And I said, what did you learn of the Acadian history? She said, I learned about the treaties that were signed, like treaty during the time of between Britain and the Acadian people. But they weren't taught the names of the people who did the deportation. They didn't know about Cornwallis, Amherst, Moncton, those things. The detail of that was very murky, right?
Extract 10.
When my parents were in school, another strange thing that took place was that they were forbidden to have the cross and the Acadian flag and the Acadian history taught, even though that's what they were taught.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 0.
Hello, my name is Louisa Lanteng, and my family comes originally from Carriquet, New Brunswick. And I want to speak in regards to the history of the Acadian and Mi'kmaq people of New Brunswick, because not a lot of Canadians know the full scope of the story.
Extract 1.
The Acadian people were relatively prosperous because the Mi'kmaq taught us how to be self-sufficient, and we had skill sets from France as well that came in with the people. And we were fishermen, we were farmers. Actually, the Acadian people created a system of farming using something called the abuato.
Extract 2.
Now, the... Acadian people were really fantastic when it came to resourcefulness and creating their own stuff. Because they had little support from France. They made their own homes, they made their own materials, they made their own fabrics.
Extract 3.
And in the colonial U.S. areas, they envied our wealth. They would come to do trade with us. We would sell them their goods, but we would sell our goods to them, but we weren't buying from them as much because we were so self-sustainable.
Extract 4.
So what they did was Amherst made the order to do the genocide using the smallpox against the Mi'kmaq people. And they did this by way of handkerchiefs and blankets that were stolen from hospitals. When they gave the wooden box, they were told not to open it until they got home or to their village to share the blessings. So that genocide took place.
Extract 5.
The Vatican Concordat, 1610, actually identified the Mi'kmaq as a nation internationally. And it was a recognition at the European level to facilitate trade between the Mi'kmaq and Europe. And this was an actual wampum that was created. It was an agreement with the Vatican directly. It had nothing to do with the crown.
Extract 6.
The Acadian people lived with us. We were one territory, one people, integrated Mi'kmaq and the Métis and the French harmoniously. Our agreement said that in order for us to maintain this treaty in good faith, we had to become Catholic. So Henri, number two, who was the sachem of the...
Extract 7.
My mom's grandfather was Laurent Lanteng. He owned a store in Saint-Simon, which is a little area outside Carriquet, New Brunswick. And he didn't know how to read. He didn't know numbers. He didn't know how to write. And he owned a shop. And he would keep tabs of all the line of credit by scrawling his own system of handwriting in the barn at the back of the store.
Extract 8.
So they did everything they could to systematically separate the people from the Catholic Church and to suppress our memory of these knowledge. But we were very good at keeping the oral tradition alive because we were indigenous people. That's how we always did it. So the story continued. Every girl in my family's first name was Marie. All the guys were Joseph. And that was the way that we kept these things going.
Extract 9.
And I said, what did you learn of the Acadian history? She said, I learned about the treaties that were signed, like treaty during the time of between Britain and the Acadian people. But they weren't taught the names of the people who did the deportation. They didn't know about Cornwallis, Amherst, Moncton, those things. The detail of that was very murky, right?
Extract 10.
When my parents were in school, another strange thing that took place was that they were forbidden to have the cross and the Acadian flag and the Acadian history taught, even though that's what they were taught.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 0.
Hello, my name is Louisa Lanteng, and my family comes originally from Carriquet, New Brunswick. And I want to speak in regards to the history of the Acadian and Mi'kmaq people of New Brunswick, because not a lot of Canadians know the full scope of the story.
Extract 1.
The Acadian people were relatively prosperous because the Mi'kmaq taught us how to be self-sufficient, and we had skill sets from France as well that came in with the people, and we were fishermen, we were farmers. Actually, the Acadian people created a system of farming using something called the abuato.
Extract 2.
Now, the Acadian people were really fantastic when it came to resourcefulness and creating their own stuff. Because they had little support from France. They made their own homes, they made their own materials, they made their own fabrics.
Extract 3.
And in the colonial U.S. areas, they envied our wealth. They would come to do trade with us, We would sell them their goods, but we would sell our goods to them, but we weren't buying from them as much because we were so self-sustainable.
Extract 4.
So what they did was Amherst made the order to do the genocide using the smallpox against the Mi'kmaq people. And they did this by way of handkerchiefs and blankets that were stolen from hospitals. When they gave the wooden box, they were told not to open it until they got home or to their village to share the blessings. So that genocide took place.
Extract 5.
The Vatican Concordat, 1610, actually identified the Mi'kmaq as a nation internationally. And it was a recognition at the European level to facilitate trade between the Mi'kmaq and Europe. And this was an actual wampum that was created. It was an agreement with the Vatican directly. It had nothing to do with the crown.
Extract 6.
The Acadian people lived with us. We were one territory, one people, integrated Mi'kmaq and the Métis and the French harmoniously. Our agreement said that in order for us to maintain this treaty in good faith, we had to become Catholic. So Henri, member 2, was the sachem of the...
Extract 7.
My mom's grandfather was Laurent Lanteng. He owned a store in Saint-Simon, which is a little area outside Carriquet, New Brunswick. And he didn't know how to read. He didn't know numbers. He didn't know how to write. And he owned a shop. And he would keep tabs of all the line of credit by scrawling his own system of handwriting in the barn at the back of the store.
Extract 8.
So they did everything they could to systematically separate the people from the Catholic Church and to suppress our memory of these knowledge. But we were very good at keeping the oral tradition alive because we were indigenous people. That's how we always did it. So the story continued. Every girl in my family's first name was Marie. All the guys were Joseph. And that was the way that we kept these things going.
Extract 9.
And I said, what did you learn of the Acadian history? She said, I learned about the treaties that were signed, like treaty during the time of between Britain and the Acadian people. But they weren't taught the names of the people who did the deportation. They didn't know about Cornwallis, Amherst, Moncton, those things. The detail of that was very murky, right?
Extract 10.
When my parents were in school, another strange thing that took place was that they were forbidden to have the cross and the Acadian flag and the Acadian history taught, even though that's what they were taught.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.